This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug. I always fuck this up.
Start again.
No, I think we should leave that one. That was good.
Yeah, just go right ahead and keep rolling it. Go ahead.
Bloopers and all
this week.
This
whole thing, including the new one.
All right.
Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Well,
we're just fine. I'm glad to see that you're following the instructions on my rider to list my name first.
I was given very specific instructions, and if you know me, you know I'm a rule follower. So
you got it.
Yeah, and lots of M&Ms, but no red ones. So it's also stock my hotel room.
Good.
All right. Everybody is anxiously awaiting Thanksgiving. You thought I was going to say something else, I'm sure, listeners, but Thanksgiving holiday is coming up, and we have a couple of questions that are diet related this week, pleasure trap related. So we'd love to hear Dr. Hawk's take on this, Dr. Lyle's take on this. So without further ado, let's just get right to it.
Sure.
Dear doctors, my wife, who's 54, and I've 61, have been married for 30 years, and we couldn't be happier. I feel like I'm the over-rewarded one, and she feels the same way. The only problem is that my high blood pressure medication is causing me to underperform in the bedroom to the point where I get extremely anxious, I feel embarrassed and guilty, that I'm losing this part of myself to old age. My doctor says it's either the meds or a stroke, so I have to follow her advice. My wife, of course, the angel that she is very supportive, but I can't help but feel guilty. So my question is how can I help her understand that I do love her and that it's not her physical appearance that is causing my malfunctions?
Well.
Oh, man.
Well, I know the answer, and it's pretty simple.
Treat the cause, sure, not the symptom.
Sure. Dr. Goldhammer and I did, God knows how long ago, it was more than 20 years ago, we published a major paper detailing, I can't remember how, I used to know these numbers exactly, but I've finally forgotten. I think it was 173 consecutive admissions over a 12-year period at True North, people that were admitted for high blood pressure, and 173 out of 173 achieved normal blood pressure off of medication. So we literally had a 100% success rate for 12 years. Then right after that time, I was real smug with somebody, and it said that we were going to fix this problem, and it turned out it didn't work. So that's because he had a hypertension that was not due, it turns out, to the normal hypertensive causes. So just shows you, just when you think you know everything, then you get it. So
hubris brings down every empire, Doug.
Yeah, she's just got a way of saying things, Nathan. Pretty soon you feel like you're talking to some Roman scholar in the 14th century. So
it's just true.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, the solution is to go to Fasting Escape, do a 10-day water fast, eat the food afterwards, and your problem's solved. So that's it. That is the solution. You could do it with diet, maybe, if you were exceptionally diligent. It turns out that the diet is not going to be as effective, but it could probably get you there. If you did a superb job for 6 months on your diet, you would probably spring back, as it were. But the most effective way to do this is going to be through water fasting. So if you can, if it's convenient enough and it's affordable, and Fasting Escape is a very reasonable place for if any of you out there are interested and you want to look into it. But this gentleman should definitely seriously look into a supervised water fast. You know, you're not going to fix this problem yourself in 3 days at home. You're going to need to go a longer distance. The average fasting length, I believe, was 10.6 days or something like that. So that was the typical length of time that we needed to achieve the results. At the end of that, you do not need high blood pressure medication because the blood pressure problem is gone. And then along with it are all the nasty side effects that come with high blood pressure medication, and we should not have a problem with erectile dysfunction. Erectile dysfunction is a physiological problem, and it's one that is generally correctable. If you are having if it's sort of hit and miss, and so you still have some ability to get erections, then it's almost certainly very correctable. If it's completely gone, it might not be. You know, there may be so much atherogenesis in that area that we may not be able to reach in there and reverse that process. But most definitely, you do not need to be on these medications, no matter what your doctor thinks. What we need to do is, as Jen says, correct the underlying problem, and fasting is the most effective way to do it.
Wonderful, Dr. Lyle.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. High blood pressure is one of those things. I think of it as it's similar to insomnia. So when I have clients who say, "Oh, I have high blood pressure" or "I have insomnia," it's I don't accept that name for your condition until you have, in the case of high blood pressure, either fasted for some amount of time or you've been extremely compliant with a no salt or very low salt diet and a whole food plant-based diet for some amount of time. Just like I don't accept that you have insomnia unless you have created an environment of pretty exquisite sleep hygiene. If you're still drinking a pot of coffee a day and telling me that you're an insomniac, that does not compute. So yeah, you have to kind of address this at the root level before you start to medicate, and certainly before you try to have a very difficult conversation with your spouse.
Yes. All good.
Thank you very much,
right.
Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, for the plug. For people who are interested, they can go to fastingescape.com to learn more about this. But yeah, that's, I see this very, very often. Like we have continued to have that 100% success rate here too. And the doctors are always really interesting. The doctors of the patients who come here, because they really don't believe the patient's going to actually not eat anything. And they don't believe the patient's going to eat the diet either. And they also don't believe that the patient's blood pressure is going to normalize. And very often I've had patients who tell me or call me or email me afterwards, and they say the doctor was shocked. And very often it's the first time in their entire career that the doctor's ever seen their patient's blood pressure improve off the meds. So it's really, really fun to watch.
Yeah. It's the single most responsive thing, I think, in fasting. I mean, fasting, no matter what Goldhammer says, it can't solve everything.
Right.
But it definitely can solve this almost always.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. People
Thank
are,
you.
Yeah. Yeah. All good.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
no,
go ahead,
no,
Dr.
No.
Lyle.
No, no, nothing further. It's all good. That's what they need to do. That's the solution. All right. What else we got?
All right. Our next question. Eating foods that make you feel horribly bad, knowing they are harming you. I find myself gluten sensitive with pain in my joints after eating it. Same with oils. Spending after time in pain and vomiting all night. Taking medications and nausea, and still I feel like I'm punishing myself and wanting the foods that are bad for me. Why am I abusing myself in such a manner? I don't get enough sleep often. Can that be the cause? Is it a deeper emotional issue? I used to be sent to my grandparents when I was as young as 1 year old till 12 years old each summer away from my parents for 3 summer months. To the Black Sea for the sun and sea waters. I was a skinny kid, and grandma and my aunt would always stuff me like a goose. So I gained weight over the summer, usually like 10 to 15 pounds. And then I'd lose it all in the winter when I come back home to city life. I hated to be away from my mom and being sent away, but why do I do it now? Nobody is stuffing me but me. Can you help me understand the cycle? P.S. I'm overweight and feel uncomfortable and unhealthy. 20 pounds over my normal weight. Thank you.
Well, Jen, this is an entertaining one. It just depends on how we feel right now. We certainly
Yeah. I mean, this is, there's a lot of backstory here, and the backstory matters almost not at all to your outcome. So this is a really common thing that people will look back in their past and do this pattern seeking to try to explain their current struggles and their current problems. And because you're stuffing yourself with foods, maybe the same foods that you ate on vacation when you were being stuffed like a goose by your grandmother, it looks like this is a cycle that you're unable to get out of that began in childhood. But really, your childhood experience has nothing to do with this other than perhaps introducing you to certain types of foods. But what's really going on is that you're dealing with fundamentally addictive substances. This is at the heart of the pleasure trap. So you're not stuffing yourself. You're indulging in foods that are harming you and making you feel like crap because those are unnatural, hyper-processed, modern foods that you're not adapted to regulate or be able to properly make use of. So you're being drawn to them as sort of a low-level addictive process. You're unable to get out of this cycle in the same way that I was unable to quit drinking alcohol when it was wrecking my life and I was not able to get a hold of it and I really wanted to quit and I would try to quit for a while and then lo and behold I'd get back into it again. And I'm sober now, but that was a major struggle because I was dealing with a substance that had hijacked the pleasure pathways in my brain, and it was not a fair fight. And food in the modern environment is exerting a very similar effect on your decision-making and on your ability to modulate your behavior and your so-called willpower when you're confronted with it. So this has nothing to do with old childhood wounds or anything that you're trying to recreate. It's absolutely just a function of the kind of food that you're being exposed to on a regular basis. And there's no easy answer. There's a process that you have to go through where you I use the phrase all the time that I got from 12-step programs, which is that relapse is part of recovery. So every time you eat this crappy food and you feel really bad physically, you are teaching your nervous system that it's not worth it to eat this food. So every time you so-called relapse on it, it makes it less likely that you're going to go that far down the track next time and indulge quite as much and harm yourself quite as much as you did the previous time. But you're still doing it because it's an addictive process. So all you can do is you know, watch that improve over time as you become more and more aware of how much it really is harming you and how little pleasure it really does give you. And try to control your environment as best as you can and keep this kind of thing that you can't stay out of your home and out of your direct path that you're going to encounter on a regular basis. And since we're, you know, pre-Thanksgiving and we're talking about the fasting escape, then you could go check yourself into jail at the fasting escape. Join our high blood pressure erectile dysfunction husband, and you guys can go keep Nathan company over Thanksgiving.
Yeah, don't make a move on the guy, though. The guy has a really happy marriage.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Good point.
Excellent. I have good news and bad news about that answer. The good news about that answer is I'm now officially redundant. And the bad news about that answer is I'm now officially redundant. Yeah. No, nothing else needs to be said. Perfect. Great stuff. Yeah.
Amazing.
All right. What else we got?
All right, so the next question that you, Dr. Hawk, and you, Dr. Lyle, have on your screen, we're going to skip that one because you just answered it. You did a two-for-one deal for us. So, just scroll. I just removed it, so just scroll one more down. And this question is, when you're caught between the pleasure trap and the ego trap for food, is one way out to somehow get to the point that you know you can eat whatever you want, but you truly don't want to eat the high-fat food? Or is the only way out to be sick and your life depends on it?
Let me think.
I can't quite parse that one. So right. I'm going to hand that one over to you. That's kind of a complicated word.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. So the The ego trap is the fear that you can't live up to expectations. So the solution to that problem is to lower the expectations to some degree, to the point where the person finally feels like they can meet the expectation. So that is the that is the general process there. Now, the what makes the ego trap, pleasure trap dynamic problematic is that if we lower the bar so far all the way to let's just eat whatever I want, then we are marching right into the pleasure trap. So there's this sort of problem in the world of healthy eating, and everybody scratches their head about it, and everybody's got an opinion, and nobody knows anything. Okay, so the most people are like you'll hear some speakers say, oh no, you got to be perfect, you got to be stay right on right on the line because it's an addictive monster. And you have other people that are saying, no, that isn't true. You would do this thing stepwise, just like you would do anything. Now, the truth of the matter is, both positions have merit, but they're everybody is ignoring individual differences. And so they're ignoring the personality factor. So therefore, we have to enter that into the equation as well. So the what it is that I do is that I listen to somebody who is in a motivational crisis. In other words, so that's what a self-destructive thing is. You are motivated to do something, and as Jen was just describing, what you're motivated to do is to activate the dopamine pathway. If that were not true, there wouldn't be a conflict. So that's clearly what the conflict is, and we understand what the hyperactivation of the dopamine pathway is doing, is it's telling you that you're doing the right thing. So that's what springs the pleasure trap. Once you become aware that that is actually a false signal, okay, so once you become aware of that, you're hungover, or your gut is just filled with 3 banana cream pies and you feel like vomiting, though you don't, and you wake up the next morning feeling sick. What happened? Well, what happened was is that the hypersignaling of the dopamine pathway as a result of a supernormal stimuli caused you to do something that was self-destructive. That in essence, it's not your fault. You were never designed to deal with a stimuli of that nature. That's why the pleasure trap, basically traps the entire gamut of people from, Nobel Prize winning physicists all the way to Skid Row bums, everything in between. So it doesn't play favorites
United
here.
United States presidents.
Okay. So in other words, it plays no favorites. What it does is it's different types of artificial stimulation are going to attack different configured nervous systems differently. So there's going to be people that will take one snort of cocaine and they're in serious trouble. Other people, cocaine won't do anything to, but alcohol or an opiate or something else will be far more problematic. So we can also see a truly reasonable a natural problem of motivation is the ego trap. So that is a natural problem. That's a social, interpersonal, and intrapersonal problem with the internal social dynamics of the individual with an internal audience. If there are expectations set up that you figure out that you probably can't meet, but either other people or your internal audience believes that you should be able to do, then we've set up a motivational crisis where the organism computes a CB and decides that they are better off not trying, and they're better off just pretending like they don't care. Okay, so that absolutely happens with pleasure trap problems, because pleasure trap problems can be very embarrassing. They can make you overweight. They can make you alcoholic. They can make you addicted to cigarettes. I had a friend of mine, a really, really nice guy, was addicted to cigarettes. You know, I met him when he was probably, you know, he was about 50 and I was about 40. And really liked him, very likable. We had a mutual friend and we spent a fair amount of time together. And he smoked. And obviously I'm me, and I've just written The Pleasure Trap, for God's sakes. And he read it. And his response was, you know what, I'm just going to, you know, I love smoking cigarettes and I'm just going to do it. And I'm going to eat otherwise helpfully, and I'll probably get away with it, and I'll just smoke as long as I can, and that's that. That's how I'm going to live my life. And it was an interesting attitude that I never challenged, but it would come up from time to time. It was clearly an ego trap process. In other words, he didn't want to admit that he might not be able to stop and try really, really hard and then fail. Okay, so he had that as an aspect of his personality. I don't know what you would call it. There was a proud streak of the personality that did not want to, you know, certain personalities are going to be more susceptible to the ego trap than others. And this particular guy was highly susceptible to the ego trap. And so he had this attitude, and this would come up, you know, over the years. And then about sometime last year or so, he got super sick and he was in a lot of pain. And it turned out he, you know, had a massive lung cancer. And he went in to see Alan. And then he said to Alan, you know, hey, I'm gonna quit. And Alan, you know, Alan's decent enough guy in the clutch. And so, but to me, Alan said, yeah, just in time. It's like, just in time. Yeah, he died 2 months later in excruciating pain. So the ego trap can be, you know, can be a devastating problem that sits alongside a pleasure trap. The pleasure trap with respect to smoking is not that hard to beat. You just have to be willing to fail at it. You got to be willing to take it on, you know, multiple times, about 8 times on average, about 2 weeks of a pretty intense unpleasantness. But the average person, if they go up to bat 8 times and they take that thing on, they'll beat it. Okay, so it's not like it would have been that hard to beat. So what did he do? He left at least 10, probably 15 years of life on the table. He spent the last 6 months of his life in excruciating pain. And then when the chips were down, he was willing to do it. Well, then it was too late. So I'm wandering all over the place with respect to this question, but the answer to the question is, you know, just has enough complex puzzles that the standard lines that we're going to get from anybody about a prescription about how to solve it are lacking the nuance that we are going to shed here, that we are trying to explain here. So number one, you have to know your own susceptibilities. Number two, you have to then realize that your job is to make improvements from where you are now and to work diligently to make those improvements, not to be seeking perfection, but to absolutely be determined to make improvements. It's good if you actually have some sort of a written record to look back on that process of improvements so that you are accountable to a record and you can also see the fact that you have succeeded as you have a written record over time. As you do that, what's going to happen, and one of the most important aspects of this problem, is to be paying attention to the nature of your self-esteem mechanism. So the self-esteem mechanism is a mechanism that resides as an interaction between the internal audience and your esteem meter. So when you do diligent work, if you do an improvement over what it is that you were doing before in the pleasure trap, and you do it consistently, your internal audience will give you a bit of a thumbs up. If you do an excellent job, the thumbs up is more firm. In other words, it is a sense of internal dignity that comes with knowing that you have done an excellent job. But if as long as you work towards it in a way where you are improving, that is what it is that you need to do. You do not need to seek perfection. It is rare for a pleasure trap problem to be so devastating that we have to be perfect. There are conditions on the continuum of addictive process where that's true. alcohol, cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, those things, you have to be perfect. Cigarettes come into range there. Food is almost never necessary that that's true. So food, your job is to make improvements, solid improvements, and then make some more, and then make some more. That's how it is that we're going to get there. And we're going to get there by watching for an internal guide that's actually talking to us, if we're paying close attention, which is the internal audience's signal to the esteem meter, i.e. the feeling of self-esteem, of moral rightness. You don't need to be perfect. You need to be good, and you need to be good quite consistently. And that's how we can beat the pleasure trap. Obviously, there are individual differences. There are people that may react to junk food in the way that somebody else reacts to alcohol. Not going to be common, though. That wouldn't be typical for the species. So most of us are simply, as what Jen has called it, we're in a low-grade addiction along with an ego trap that is basically sent to us by an outside observation of the problem that says, hey, this shouldn't be that tough. And yet it's actually tougher than people think. As a result, it sets up an ego trap. And then between the two of those things, the ego trap and the pleasure trap, set a trap that can be remarkably difficult to get out of. So that's how we do it. We do it with an intentional improvement over where it is that you are, and then some record keeping that's involved, and then watching for the self-esteem mechanism improving its signaling, and then understanding that a feeling of that you are better, that you are doing a better job, and a feeling of pride in that is not happening by accident, and that's a critical guidance system for you to grasp, because that makes it far more worth it to be diligent. Okay? When we seek goals of attempting to improve our diets, it's almost always as a result of weight loss motivation, which is almost always as a result of improving our attractiveness, which is always a result of an imagination of how great life is going to be once we get to that goal and get the esteem from people that we seek esteem from. And instead, what we want to do is we want to understand that the guidance system that's critical is going to be the internal audience's signaling of self-esteem along the process. If we can get focused on that and learn and understand it, we're much less likely to let it go. And that's the solution to that problem.
Dr. Lyle, thank you. I'm reminded of the talk that you gave at Chef AJ's conference last year, mm-hmm. where I remember you said that feeling you can't get anywhere else other than earning it.
Yes.
And that we should be chasing that feeling for the rest of our life, and that knowing yes. that we can only get it through diligent effort. And it's incredible, Dr. Lyle. Thank you.
Good. That's right on target, Nathan. That's exactly what we're talking about. All right.
I can just jump in really quickly.
Sure, please.
There's something kind of implied in so much of what you're talking about that is not that we don't often make fully explicit, but I sort of touched on it a little earlier when I was talking about relapse being part of recovery as well, which is that part of the ego trap, or one of the facets of the ego trap that people get into, is that they're just going to get this one day, that
right.
they need to listen to some more podcasts and watch some more videos, and they just can't get it together. And they're just, one of these days they're going to figure it out. And they know everything. And, you know, I've had some success, but then I slipped back, and then I just can't seem to get it together. And it's like, you need to realize that for almost everybody who is trying to solve this problem, this is a lifelong back and forth dance between feeling that dignity and feeling the disgust when you slip up, and then going back into the dignity. It's a roller coaster. You're not going to one day have it just kind of fall into place and then be on the path of ever accruing self-esteem for the rest of your life because you've got it figured out and you're doing the right thing. It's almost certain that you're going to have moments where you slip up, where you get indulgent, you get derailed for one reason or another. There's things are going to happen. And so that contributes to people's high expectations for themselves and their level of self-loathing for not being able to figure it out and solve the problem. because it's really not an overnight thing. It looks like it is for a lot of people who are successful in the plant-based world. But for almost everybody who is trying to tackle this low-grade addictive process, it's because it's not something that is an all-or-nothing, do-or-die proposition like alcohol is for me. It's something you have to manage over the rest of your lifetime. And for almost all of us, that's going to be a 5 steps forward, 2 or 3 steps back, 5 steps forward kind of process. It's an ongoing journey that you just get to kind of deal with. And it's like, that's good and bad news. And we have lots of different tools for helping manage that. Fasting escape is one of them. But I think people need to check their expectations a little bit for how good they need to be in order to be successful. Like you need to recalibrate what it means to be successful and improvement over time, even if that includes a lot of slipping and a lot of retreading old territory, is still improvement.
Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. And you're so right, because nothing else that we do in the world works that way. Like when Dr. Lyle, you were right, getting really good at free throws. It's not like you put your foot down, stomped on the floor and said, today I'm going to make a decision and make all the free throws. You had to practice at it, practice at it, and no amount of watching basketball helped you do that.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Jen, that was fabulous. Dignity and disgust. They're literally, it's literally a protean system.
Right.
And it's flipping back and forth, and it's the pleasure trap is dragging us into self-destructive and therefore self-disgust, processes. And the other side of that is the self-discipline, going, beating your genes, going against that, and earning the dignity of that is, part of the process, self-esteem signal. Fantastic. I drafted Jordan, except she's a lot prettier.
It's very sweet. And I don't like basketball.
Yeah, well, so what? Just get used to it.
Close enough, yeah. Yes, we're very lucky to have you on, Dr. Hawk. We appreciate
it. Oh, my gosh. It's great. Great stuff. Incredible. Beautiful.
Thank you.
All right. What else we got, Nathan?
Well, we got two questions. Both are the pleasure trap, but slightly different nuances. So if mm-hmm. they get redundant, Dr. Lyle, I hope. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dear doctors, the best definition of the pleasure trap that I could derive from your book is the state of addictively pursuing low-cost, highly available, often hyper-stimulating pleasures at the expense of health and happiness. However, you state in the summary of Chapter 4, the miracle and madness of modern medicine that, quote, modern medicine, which can help us lessen our pain but fail to help the body heal itself, can also be a pleasure trap. Mm-hmm. This leads me to think that my definition might be too narrow, or at best, it is the only one definition of a term that has many. Would you be willing to provide a succinct, complete definition of the term, or spell out the different ways that you use the term in the book?
Yes. We could pull it succinct. Let Jen can use those kind of fancy words. All right. What a pleasure trap is it's a motivational dilemma where the individual is confronting stimuli that were not part of its natural history. As a result, those stimuli can either be hyperactivating a pleasure pathway, or they can be shutting down a pain pathway. Either way, they appear to be causing improvements, when in fact, they are fooling the system, and a destructive process is actually taking place. So that's what a pleasure trap is. Pleasure trap is an artificial stimuli activating a circuit, causing an inference that we are experiencing biological success when in fact we are not. So that's, we'll take that. I think that's pretty complete. Does that sound pretty complete, Jen? Yeah, of course.
Oh, that's worries. Right.
Got it.
No worries.
Yeah.
You got to use DoorDash later after the recording.
There's no DoorDash in Maui, fortunately, oh for all involved.
Yeah.
No, I think it was the post office lady, but it's like she doesn't normally knock, so that was strange. Yeah, that sounds perfectly right. I think if people can kind of get into the weeds with the semantics a little bit, when, you know, we're talking about the most of the time when we're referring specifically to the pleasure trap, we're talking about the culinary pleasure trap and
right.
the ways people get into it, and sometimes expanding that to mean other addictive processes. But that reference to modern medicine is getting to the broader concept and the ways in which we can wander into everything that glitters in the modern world that does not ultimately serve our interests in the best possible way.
Yeah. It's the fooling of the system.
Okay. Yeah,
that's really what the pleasure trap is. It's fooling a nervous system that was designed for a whole host of natural stimuli, and to evaluate those stimuli accurately with respect to survival and reproductive outcomes. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so if you create stimuli that the system is not designed for, then you can wind up with mistakes. That's how that works. Wonderful. And Melly concurs, by the way.
Yep. All right, so our final question. Dear doctors, I'm curious as to why and how we got it so wrong for so long with regards to genetics versus environment. We blame genetics for chronic diseases like diabetes, high cholesterol, and cancer. And we blame environment for our personalities, intelligence, behaviors, and life choices, when in reality it's the complete opposite. Who we are individually is genetic, and what diseases we get are driven mostly by environment, like food and lifestyle. Once we found out that the Earth was round and revolves around the sun, most people caught on. How long do you think it will take for society to, quote, catch on to the truth about genes and environment?
Great, fabulous question, and I love it. And I have actually pondered the same thing. And I haven't quite thought it through until just now, which is why I love to do Q&A, because people then ask me questions and I have to answer them. And I look through the file and I a lot of times come up with it. And so, Jen, see what you think about this. It's quite possible that one of the reasons why this mistake is being made from both these opposite directions is for status. So think about this, that if we can blame a disease process on nature, on individual nature, then number one, the doctor doesn't have a status problem. And number two, the person is not self-destructed through self-indulgence. So that's all very convenient. Okay. On the other side of it, when it comes to how smart you are in your personality, whatever deficits you have, let's blame them on our parents and our upbringing.
Yeah, nothing innate to you.
Nothing innate to me. My genes are fine, okay? So, and also, my kid has unlimited potential. Don't tell me it's limited. So we can sell the possible emergent inter-beauty of our average child to the village, saying how great, you know, they're going to be, and we hold out hope and we continue to invest in that process. Etc. So I could see possibly status-related issues being complicit in this strange-looking dichotomy. Does that ring any truth, Jen, or what do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, once we found out the Earth was round and revolves around the sun, most people caught on, but not people who had, you know, skin in the game, not the Catholic Church, not people who had a financial interest in the opposite outcome. So we see exactly the same thing now, where it's maybe it's hard to say with the chicken and egg problem when it begins with status and when it becomes incentivized by institutional structures and
right.
people's careers and financial pathways and all of the different things that we could point to on both sides of this equation in the medical industrial complex and in the blank slate world, particularly in education and parenting and the new age movement and everything else that talks about, you know,
right.
how you have unlimited potential and if only you weren't this bruised little banana that was irrevocably damaged by your parents, you'd be, you know, this great triumphant character. So yeah, I think it's a mix between people dealing with very, very strong and very salient financial incentives, political incentives, status incentives, and just the fact that this is all really entrenched culturally and institutionally at this point. I mean, we certainly talk about this all the time. We talk about, you know, how has science turned its back on this incredibly robust evidence that we have from behavioral genetics, particularly on the blank slate side of the equation. It's a travesty. It's a miscarriage of scientific justice, and in psychology as well as all throughout the social sciences. And so we are obsessed with this question and spend a lot of time asking ourselves this very thing. And when you're confused, look to the status. That's one of our main rules about trying to understand human behavior. So, yeah, this person is tapping into exactly one of the things that we talk about quite extensively in the book, and is of great interest to both of us. We also talk about this a lot in the on our website in the membership section with the history of modern psychology. There's a whole module for members where we really get into where we went wrong and why blank slate thinking triumphed over behavioral genetics and reason, essentially. So if people are interested, they can watch that too. I think there's 4 hours of digging very deep into that question.
Yes, but this is a beautiful question. And as Jen is, it's actually amazing for me what enlightenment I've got from my friendship with Jen has been all around. I don't think in terms of institutions. I never have. It's always been belly to belly, me 3 feet, 4 feet away from the client, and the two of us are walking through their brain trying to figure out, like, I don't care about anything else in the world. All I care about is improving their existence. But Jen, as a political scientist, comes from a worldview of institutions and systems. And it's always stunning for me to listen to you reason things out, because at the heart of it, what we have here is certainly in academia and then widening out of academia, the culture is intellectually corrupt, and that is to me, you know, I have been rolling my eyes in disgust over it and slapping people quietly in therapy, not physically, sort of the old,
the old
aftershave thing, slapping the guy on each side, and he says, "Thanks, I needed that," like that. That's been
stop it.
That's why you do phone consults.
Yeah, that's right. So, in other words, that's sort of what I've been doing as a therapist and counselor, and then Jen comes along and says, "Whoa, you don't even understand how deep and wide this corruption is. It's chilling," and you know, I was aware of it, but I didn't actually understand something that she puts her finger on so beautifully, so many places, in stuff that we have talked about and done and we're writing, and that is incentives, that systems start to be set up, and then there is it's kind of a you know, this is how the world works, that once a system is set up, it's and incentivized in a certain way, it can run down a bad path forever. Just look at the world economies and how incompetent they are at solving the basic economic problems of humans. Like, all over the world, there are people that live in places where there's a lot of talent and a lot of brains, but they can't get themselves organized worth a damn because the existing systems are corrupt. So in our country, of course, there's corruption. There's inherent corruption in any governmental process, but the amount of it is minuscule, and the system works extremely well relative to how badly it can work and how badly we do see it. But on the intellectual side of things now in the 20th century, particularly late 20th century and 21st century, it is, you know, there are components of this that are rotten to the core. And this questioner has identified this, and Jen and I do. We just, you know, I walk around lamenting and questioning and irritated, and then Jen explains. That's how we do.
It's enraging, though. You know, I mean, when people sort of start to open their eyes and, you know, they're so-called red-pilled on this kind of stuff, you start to see the hypocrisy with the, you know, the mixed incentive structures that are rewarding blank slate thinking over here, but reverting to genetic determinism over here. And it's like, well, which one is it? You know, like, you gotta choose your pathway. You don't get to have both of these things at the same time. And so it becomes, I think, you know, it's people are asking questions like this, and I hear this from clients, because mm-hmm. you're watching the dissonance of hypocritical thinking that is being buffered by strong institutional interests.
Yeah, and to one question to a component of the question, sort of how long can it last? That's a great question. We don't know, and we have one of our beautiful optimists, Robert Plowman, saying, it's all coming down in 10 years because of personal genomics.
Yeah, once everyone's got their little polygenomic readout, you know, it's right. Like, okay, well, this is how it is.
He's probably right in the sense that probably by the end of my life, it will probably be so necessary for systems to be competitive to have to acknowledge genetic individual differences in humans that it will become as commonplace in the discussion as sort of evolution is in common discussion now, okay? You couldn't even breathe the word evolution in 1970. That meant you were an atheist and you were a bad person and you didn't like people and you were just a disagreeable SOB. That's where you were in 1970, okay? Today, you can use that word sort of casually and get away with it in mixed company. You know, like it's actually gotten that sort of has become more accepted as the concepts of the genetic code and nature shows and planet Earth and everything else under the sun has sort of seeped more into the popular culture as far as that goes. Now, that hasn't walked its way over into the enlightenment that we see when it comes to human beings, but it's going there. And so, things are definitely going to change, but they're going to change slowly and painfully, and it's going to be,
one funeral at a time.
That's exactly what it is.
Well, yeah. And I think we're the flip side of that is that there's going to be this interesting intellectual schism where you know there are increasingly people who understand how it really is have had their eyes open to the truth, and then you also and at the same time you have ever more powerful structural, I'm sounding very conspiratorial here, but this is true. Like, you know, put your tinfoil hat on and buckle up, because this is in academia in particular, you have a lot of people who are just now reaching, you know, the very beginning of a multi-decade career who are very invested in blank slate thinking in the social sciences. So I think the social sciences are going into a real dark age for the remainder of my lifetime, more or less. Even though there are these pockets of extraordinary insight and people doing really incredible work who are largely marginalized from those mainstream conversations. And so I think the end result is the undermining and the you know, delegitimization of academia as we go through these next decades, where the value of my PhD in a social science from an Ivy League university gets corroded by the fact that these institutions will continue to defend defend to the death these these mystical untruths of blank slate thinking. So that's a really, it's a weird place to sit where we have more and higher quality information about how, what human nature is really about and how humans really work than we ever have. We tacitly use it in the form of data analytics, which if, you know, personality wasn't incredibly stable and behavior couldn't be incredibly well predicted from it, then data analytics would be useless. So we sort of have this strange use of these facts that is emerging in that whole venue of life, but we can't acknowledge it from a behavioral genetic standpoint or from, you know, anything that looks more solidly evidence-based. So yeah, it's a weird place. It's a weird place to sit.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not in academia.
Yeah. Aren't we? Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, Dr. Hawk, you will always be a pre-2020 Harvard grad to me. So.
Yeah, that's right. Seriously, I'm not even joking. Like, it matters. Like, when, oh, you're a Harvard PhD? What year did you get your degree? Was it pre or post the blank slate, you know, the
shutdowns.
The coming of the
shutdown.
Yeah.
There you go.
I mean, it's the... Well, yeah, that's a whole other rant. Never mind. I was going to start talking about Vonnegut, but we can do that next week. People should read Harrison Bergeron if they haven't already. Well, I'll just leave it there.
Okay.
Got it.
Well, that was as close as we got to our bad 2020 joke. And, you know, I'm happy to report that's the only one of this entire year that I've had. So
there you go.
Oh, good. Yeah. We're doing very well.
Excellent.
Well, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much for these thorough answers. Thank you for the plug for Fasting Escape. For our listeners, if you were curious about this history of modern psychology, you can go to www.esteemdynamics.com, and that's where Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk have their information. And you can join the Living Wisdom Library. A lot of good lectures there in little pieces, personality, psychology, everything. So.
All right.
Well, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, I hope you guys have a fabulous Thanksgiving in Hawaii. And we look forward to talking to you next show.
All right. Fantastic.
Yeah, a lot of purple sweet potatoes on demand here. So.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
Oh, they're so good. They're so good. Yeah.
Fabulous, everybody. Yeah. All right, guys.
All right.
All right.
Have a good one. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. Thank you, Nathan. All right. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.